And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
Well, this is a first. I have never before recorded a podcast at a hospital, but this one I am recording at the Eisenhower Hospital in Rancho Mirage, California. By the way, an amazing hospital. I just can't say enough about the care and attention. But I'm here, and they're going to keep me for another day, but that can't keep me from recording the piece that needs to go out this week. So I'm going to give you what I promised, and that is the next segment in the series, the boot camp series, of some 10 to 12 pieces that represent what we consider to be the biggest decisions you're going to make as an investor. And in each of these segments, we're going to give you a podcast, an article, a video, and in almost every case, lots of tables and numbers to help you in your investment decision-making process. Now, up to this point, we had gotten through a couple of the segments. The first one was all about the decision of stocks versus bonds. And hopefully we convinced you that particularly if you are an early investor, young investor, that for the long-term investments that really to be all in stocks is going to be the right decision. And that segment was followed by a discussion of the ultimate buy and hold strategy, which is really a convenient and hopefully impactful way to look at the implications of putting together many different equity asset classes. So the idea is, yes, there's diversification of companies within a fund, but there are also different equity asset classes that can be combined, two different levels of important diversification. In that presentation, we did talk a little bit about the sound investing portfolios, because the next thing I want to zero in on now is how to put these equity asset classes together. In the next presentation, we will show the implications of adding fixed income to these different portfolios. But right now, we're talking all equities, and we're talking about basically nine portfolios that theoretically could be part of your portfolio. And I want to dig deep into the risk and the return, short-term, intermediate, long-term, so that you can get a really great idea of what to expect out of each of these combinations. Now, there is a link in the note field to three tables. And one table, table H1A, is a table that basically shows you the different ways to put together these equity asset classes. Now, in that ultimate buy and hold strategy podcast, we showed a very simple 10% each in 10 different equity asset classes, some U.S., some international, some large, small, value, growth, REITs, emerging markets, a lot of diversification. On the other hand, with all that diversification comes the work of managing a more complex portfolio. So as you look at table H1A, what you will see is the diversification that would be used to build each one of these different portfolios, so that what you'll only have to do once you decide which of these strategies that you want to use, what you're going to be left having to figure out is what ETFs or mutual funds to use to do it. And we'll be getting to that certainly in future segments. So the H1A table is basically just the percentage of each of the equity asset classes that you would have in a portfolio. Let me just give you a simple one. The U.S. four-fund strategy and the four funds or the four asset classes, 25% each, S&P 500, large cap value, small cap blend, and small cap value. They're very simple. Anybody could follow these once they choose the one that they're going to use in their portfolio. Now, the real powerhouse table here comes next, and that is table H2A. Now, H2A takes these same, all of these combinations, these nine different combinations, and shows risk and return in a number of different ways. So I hope if you aren't able to sit and look at this table while I'm speaking here, I hope you'll stop the podcast, get the table, take a look at it, so you'll get a sense of what I'm talking about. So I can actually take very little credit for what a clever way of presenting this information, I think, is. That is, this is the work of Daryl Balls, our director of analytics at our foundation. Because what I wanted Daryl to do was simply to put together a table where people could compare the returns of all of these different portfolios. What he did to make it more interesting and way more educational is he broke it down and looked at these combinations in a number of important ways. So as I look at table H2A, at the top, what I notice is that this table is 50-50 U.S. international. So when we're including U.S. and international in a portfolio, you're going to have half in each major asset class. Now, in some cases, there is no international, but when there is international, the assumption is it's a 50-50. Now, another day, we will talk about the 70-30 of this similar kind of a presentation. But for now, here's what I want you to notice. Along the top are the returns of a $10,000 investment made in 1970 through 2023. And what would that have grown to over that 54-year period if you had just put the $10,000 in, didn't add any money, didn't take any money out, a lump sum investment? And as I've talked about before, when it's a lump sum investment, it doesn't matter what the sequence of returns are. It doesn't matter where the 50% up happened in the first year or the last year, the return is going to be the same. So it makes it easy to compare since you don't have the variables of adding money or taking money out. We will do that later. So here's what I see immediately. I see the S&P 500, the $10,000 grew to about almost $2.4 million. And I can see that the other eight portfolios in each case made more. And they made more sometimes by a little and sometimes by a whole lot. For example, the worldwide ultimate buy and hold portfolio that we talked about last week, it ended with about $4.4 million. The four fund worldwide, $4.7 million. The U.S. four fund, $4.8 million. The worldwide all value, $6.2 million. The U.S. all value, $7.4 million. And if you were really aggressive with a part of your money and you put it into small cap value worldwide, half U.S., half international, that grew to almost $11 million. And the small cap value U.S. itself, about $10.3 million. That's without any international. And finally, the two-fund strategy, half S&P 500, half small cap value, $5.5 million. Now, the only point I want to make here is this. if the risk isn't too great to get this additional return. Obviously, we would wanted to have done that. The problem is that we can't do that. We can't buy it after it's already happened. And so all we can use this information for is some sort of a sense of what kind of return might you get in the future. And by the way, you're going to find out the return here is all over the place. Good times, bad times, in between times. You get it all thrown at you during this 54 years. But I think it's remarkable that in every case, it's almost like at a minimum, you're going to double the return on your investment by expanding your diversification and including more of these asset classes. And it might even be four or five times as much money in the end. So this is really a huge decision for somebody who's talking about investing over a very long period of time. Now, the next thing that, let me just share then, in the next box, it's the blue box that Daryl created. And in the blue box are the compound annualized growth rates, first from 1970 through 2023, for the whole period. So, for example, the S&P 500 was 10.7%, and the two-fund strategy, the U.S. S&P 500 and small cap value, it was 12.4%. The worldwide all value was 12.7%, a range of returns. And remember, every 0.5% that we can find or we can get out of an investment, particularly if you're starting at a relatively young age, can be an extra million to $1.5 million. So these differences are very meaningful. But then what Daryl wants us to do is to notice that when you look at it in 10-year increments, how different one 10-year from the next can be. And what happens to all of us, we all have a recency bias, and what's happened recently appears to be more important than what happened many years ago. So if you happen to live through a really good time, it is natural to think that good time is going to continue. Or if you live through a really bad time, it's not unusual that people say, never again. I've invested for the last time. I'm not going to lose money in the stock market again. But I think this is a beautiful presentation in that I can see one decade at a time, the good times and the bad. Let me go to the bad times. 2000 through 2009, that was the worst of the bad time decades. The S&P 500 lost 1% a year. Now, that is not catastrophic. What may have been felt catastrophic is twice during that 10-year period, the market was down 50%. So a 10-year period is going to hide a lot of difficult times and give the investment time to work out to be productive. Well, when I see that from 2000 to 2009, that it lost 1% a year, as I look across the rest of the page, it didn't matter whether I added a whole bunch of other asset classes or one additional asset class, it got better. Because it just so happened that during that 10-year period, that was the worst time for the S&P 500 in the last 54 years, at least in terms of a decade. But the other returns varied from 4.2 up to 10.5. So having more diversification, you can see the advantage of doing that. Now, you're also going to see, if you look at the best of times, you're going to see the S&P 500 had two decades in a row 80 through 89 that it compounded at 17.5, and from 90 to 99 at 18.2. That made investing look very simple. And of course, it isn't simple at all, but that was what happened during that period of time. And as you look across at the other combinations, what you're going to see is that the S&P 500 was among the very best. And in fact, it was a great period for almost every combination. But there's no question, as is often the case with the S&P 500, it was at the top of the heap for a very long period of time. And I suspect that it made people question, why own anything else but just the S&P 500? Well, keep in mind, those two decades happened right before the decade that had the 1% loss per year. So this is the difficult thing about investing, is staying the course in good times and bad. And I also believe that if there's anything we can do to modify the volatility and still get a good return, or maybe, as we see here, even better, that is something we want to try to apply to our selection of the portfolio. Now, the next box is green. Green suggests profitability, and in fact, this box is all about profitability. What Darrell did was he looked at all of the profitable years of each one of these portfolios. And by the way, I even consider holding the S&P 500 all by itself a portfolio. So it doesn't mean you have to have more than one asset class in a particular portfolio. Yes, you could do it all in one. And in fact, there are a lot of people who do have all of their money either in the S&P 500 or the total market index. So here's what I see. The S&P 500 had 43 years that it made money. And in those 43 years, the average gain was 18.9%. And Darrell then took the sum of all of those up years, 813.3%, and he listed the very best year, and in the case of the S&P 500, 37.5%. That happened in 1995. Now, we can then look at all of the other combinations, and we can compare them to the S&P 500. And I only suggest that because the S&P 500 is typically considered to be the benchmark that that people are trying to keep up with, or if they can beat it, they feel like they've done well. Well, here's what I find interesting. Every one of the other combinations had a greater sum than the 813.3%. Well, that's probably not a shock to most of you, because all the rest of these portfolios had a better track record. But here you can get a sense of, one, how often were they profitable? And most of them were profitable. Well, let's see. Actually, there are three that were profitable 43 times. There are two that are profitable 41 times. There are three that are profitable in 42 of the years. And one was profitable in 45. That happens, by the way, to be the worldwide all value. That's a combination of large and small U.S. and large and small international, and a slice of emerging markets. So we can see how all of these different strategies performed in the good times. What was the average return during that up year? And we can see which was the best year and how big a year was it. Now, in the case of the U.S. four-fund strategy, 1975, it was up 51.4%. In that same year, the U.S. all value was up 57%. Anyway, you can look at these numbers when you have time and compare and contrast them. But then he's got the red box. And the red box is the downtime. That's the period of time when people were losing money. And what we see here is that all of them had a lot of losing years. It looks to me like three of them had 11 losing years, and two of them had 13 losing years, three had 12 losing years, and one had 9 losing years. Again, that's the worldwide all value. So when we look at the S&P 500 on this table, we see that there were the 11 years. Average loss was 14.5, and the sum of all of the losing years was 159.2%. So if all of those years came in a row, then you would have lost a lot of money. But the worst year was a loss of 37% in 2008. And by the way, 2008 was the worst year for all of them. But I can compare and contrast the S&P 500 with all of the rest of these. For example, the two-fund strategy that I talk a lot about, the S&P 500 and Small Cap Value 50/50. It had 12 losing years instead of 11 that the S&P 500 had. But when you total all of those 12 years, the total was 141.1% versus the total loss for the S&P was 159.2. So that tells me, through that lens, that the two-fund strategy was, in fact, no more risky, maybe even less risky, than the S&P 500. But the end result was $2.4 million versus $5.5 million. And again, this is the past, can't be purchased, but I think that, and the academics would agree theoretically with what has happened here, because they would tell you that these other equity asset classes, while they are more risky, produce the same or better returns. Now, we have looked at the upside. We've looked at the downside. We can also look at the other ways of measuring a risk. And I'm not going to dive into that, because those who are interested will look up and read about what a Sharpe ratio is, and then you can compare that and what a Sortino ratio is. What we're trying in these different ratios to determine is, what is that relationship between risk and unit of return? And I will just tell you that all of those kinds of ratios that you will look at here, the S&P 500 was the least productive. I've said this before, and it's an important thing to remember. The reason it's the least productive is because it is the least risky here, in terms of the unit of return per unit of risk. So when you took more risk and went outside beyond the S&P 500, one thing that happens is that you end up historically with a better rate of return. But when you risk adjust it, it's even better, because it suggests that you took more risk and you got a better return above and beyond just the risk that you took. You got a premium for the unit of return per unit of risk. Now, there's one more page of numbers, and it's a bunch of tiny numbers, but it's an important, I think it's a really important set of numbers to look at, because now we're showing every one of these portfolios 1 year at a time, going back to 1970. And the reason I think it's valuable to take a look at this table, this is H3A, is that it looks at a year, not at 10 years, not just at the good times, just at the bad times, but it does. It looks at 1 year at a time. And that's what you're going to have to live with as an investor. We can talk about if you just wait 10 years, everything's going to be okay. We don't know that it's going to be okay. And we tend to be way more critical of what happens in a year. But here's what I want you to notice as you go through this page. First of all, when you look at the good years, you are going to see, in some cases, huge differences in returns from one particular strategy to the next. And by the way, it turns out that you have some big differences during the worst of times. Now, it's more important how things turn out, I think, during the worst of times, because that is when your risk tolerance is tested. We don't get tested on the way up, we get tested on the way down. So when you look, for example, at table H3A, you would see, for example, here in 1973, the S&P 500 lost 14.7%, and in 1974, it lost 26.5%. And that was a period, during that period, the market did go down over 50%. And you look, as you go across, you're going to see that some of the strategies, remember, they're all more risky, did in fact take a deeper loss, and some actually came out considerably ahead of the S&P 500. For example, the worldwide all value I've talked about several times. By the way, I'm not selling it. I'm not recommending it as the best place to go. But it is interesting that in 1973, instead of losing 14.7, it lost 8.6. Now, it did lose a little more in 1974. It lost 30, while the S&P 500 lost 26.5. But each year, you can take a look and see how did the S&P 500 do compared to the others. Sometimes, like 1977, the S&P 500 down 7.3%. On the other hand, the average returns for all of the other portfolios, that return is up over 20%. The worst performer was the U.S. 4 Fund, up 8.8. The best performer was Worldwide Small Cap Value, up 47. So these are huge differences in returns. Not only from the S&P 500 to the others, but within the whole group, you're going to see how much difference that you might have. 1981, by the way, was another year, the S&P 500 down 4, and the rest of the strategies made from 5 to 20%. Then you run into the probably the point at which you're going to be most happy you had diversified beyond the S&P 500 was not just the loss of 7%, but if you looked at 2000 through 2002, down 9.1, down 11.9, down 22.1, three bad years in a row. And in there is another 50% loss. On the other hand, if you looked, I'm going to look back at that worldwide all value, up 1, up 1.9, down 6.9. If I looked at the all U.S. value, up 10.8, up 13, and down 12. So there are places that you can, in theory, hide during the worst of times, sometimes. But you can't just you can't make your return just from hiding during the bad times. You also have to do well during the good times. And that's what you're looking for. Things that do well, generally speaking, in both cases. Then you can have a year like 2008. Everybody lost money. From 37% up to 42%. So it was a terrible time for all of these combinations. So I hope that you'll take the time to sort through these different strategies and the different rates of return. In theory, as you look back for just one sec before we close this segment, let's go back and look at the H2A table, because here is, I guess, where you're going to probably have the best shot at figuring out what's right for you. I think the variables are going to be, first of all, how many different equity asset classes do you want to be in? The second thing is, do you want to include international? Now, in another discussion, you'll have an opportunity to look at the 70-30 portfolios as well. Very similar returns, by the way. So it is not hugely different. But I can tell you this, that the U.S. two-fund strategy, because one is small value and the other is large blend, gives you a balance of large and small and growth and value, but all U.S. On the other hand, if you took the four-fund strategy, you're going to have some more diversification, but you're going to end up with about $700,000 less at the end of that 54-year period. But as you sort through there, and by the way, let me encourage you to ask questions. I have mentioned in the earlier segments that we are trying to do some new things here we haven't in the past on these individual pages that we're building, where we have the video and the podcast and the article and the tables. But we also are going to be taking your questions, answering them, and then putting the answer there for other people who are interested in the Q&As about the sound investing portfolios or about any of the other subjects. And the other thing, I think I've mentioned this, or maybe it's something that I've been working on offline, but it is also my hope on many of these important decisions that we find what we consider to be important instructional material from other people. And in most cases, they're going to come from our truth tellers. Not always. We want to make sure that you have a chance to read and listen and watch to the best information that we can find to help you. So I hope this has been helpful to you. And I got through this. I was only interrupted one time during my recording here at the hospital. None of the alarms or the things that beep and scream at me from time to time went off. So it was, it was just as easy as working at home. I'm not planning to do this again, I might say. Thanks for listening. Share it with friends if you think it'll help.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.